Welcome to the Tim Moen Show. Got something special for you today, but let's set the stage here for what we're about to talk about. In 1910, a highly secretive meeting took place on Jekyll Island off the coast of Georgia. That paved the way. It was a group of bankers meeting in secret with a senator named Aldrich. That paved the way for the creature that was born on Jekyll Island, namely the Federal Reserve. And since then, the Federal Reserve and central banks have whittled away close to 98% of our buying power. Our dollar is worth about 98% less than it was in 1910. This is what Ludwig von Mises had to say about it. The gold standard did not collapse. Governments abolished it in order to pave the way for inflation. The whole grim apparatus of oppression and coercion, policemen, customs guards, penal courts, prisons, in some countries, even executioners, had to be put into action in order to destroy the gold standard. Solemn pledges were broken. Retroactive laws were promulgated. Provisions of constitutions and bills of rights were openly defied. And hosts of servile writers praised what the governments had done and hailed the dawn of the fiat money millennium. That was from 1910 to present. We have the central banking system that we now know. In Canada, we used to have a system of free banking where banks were allowed to fail, and that was considered just fine. You know, it's a market. There's a market in money, but now everything is under one centralized control, right out of the communist playbook. Our money has been whittled down. And not only that, our lives have been controlled by this. You don't support a war, well, tough. We're going to print money and go to war. You don't support bailouts, well, tough. We're going to print money and rob your buying power and confiscate your wealth and give it to the oligarchs, those connected to power. You could argue that culture is defined by central banks. You see obese people, blame a central bank. It encourages consumption. Of course, Mises and the Austrian economists said that they were the opposite of Keynesians. Keynesians say that in order to stimulate an economy, what you need to do is get more consumption. Well, what Mises and the boys said is, no, you need production. What do you need to do to produce? Well, first of all, you need to save. You need to be able to, but of course, central banking robs people, prevents them from saving, encourages them to indulge in immediate gratification right down the line, whether it's a new truck or that Big Mac or whatever. Immediate gratification is where it's at. And so central banks have been controlling our lives for a better part of a century. And now they're about to go on steroids, as my next guest is going to talk about the creation of central bank digital currencies. And I'm pleased to welcome this next guest. Me and him go back a little ways. I actually ran for parliament in his riding. He was a former MP from Calgary Signal Hill who was known for speaking his truth, telling it like he saw it. And that sparked controversy. And he was a refreshing voice in Parliament. He was Machiavellianly stabbed in the back and had his riding taken from under him by a red Tory who I also did not like, named Ron Lippert, who was the health minister in Alberta in charge of centralizing emergency medical services. And that's why I went to that riding, because I wanted to hold Lippert's feet to the fire. And Rob and I met then, and we've been good acquaintances since then. So join me in welcoming former member of parliament, Rob Anders. Thanks for joining us, Rob.
Good to be on the show. And, you know, your comments about Ludwig von Mises are haunting. I remember looking at, you know, what gold was worth, say, for example, pre-World War I, where it was about $20 an ounce, you know, type of thing. And I remember I had a house that was built just previous to the big 1929 stock market crash, beautiful Tudor revival that was in Saanich, close to Victoria. And that house, you know, if you did it in the dollars of the day, it would have been the equivalent of basically 3 gold coins, you know, at the time. Right. And the price, the value of it today, or when I was paying interest on the mortgage, was still about 3 gold coins. It was exactly the same. But try to pay that with $60, you know, 20 times 3 today, I mean, it was like 6,000, right? So it just goes to show you the 98% devaluation. But what you're saying perfectly ties into what I've done by going down the rabbit hole in central bank digital currency. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, I'm very curious to find out what you've learned about this and what kind of threat it offers. I mean, you know, those of us who have been warning about central banking for decades have been talking about how it controls every aspect of our life, but this sounds like it's stepping up a notch. Do you want me to just put the presentation on and you sure. go through it?
Sure. Absolutely. Okay. Let's do that. You bet. So hopefully everybody can see that. It's called Central Bank Digital Currency Equals Communism. And, you know, first off let's look at early money. Okay. So in early money, you know, people call it biblical money, scriptural money, you know, but you look at it, gold, silver, copper, have been, you know, honest, hard, asset-based money, since, you know, the beginning of recorded history. So we've got the Lydian lion here that goes back to 610 BC, the Ying Yuan of China. Irony now, because China's leading the parade on the central bank digital currency, and I'll talk about that. You've got the gold Darius out of Persia, going back to 520 BC. Then you've got, obviously, the silver turtle in Greece, the Karshapana out of India. You've got Ionia. You've got the drachma of Greece, the denarius of Rome, which, of course, is famous in all sorts of ways. And then you have, obviously, China had copper as well. And then you have the Assis out of Rome. So it's been the basis for real money for quite some time. And when we went to fiat currency, what happened was you had at least a fractional reserve where people would say, okay, well, if the bank's going to issue some money, they have to keep either 25% at one point as low as 3% of these hard assets to back that stuff up in case people wanted to come and claim the real hard asset. So anyhow, that's a little bit of history.
Right, right. And I mean, even back then, governments were trying to mess with our money, right? I mean, in Rome, I recall they tried to, didn't they water down the money supply by minting coins with lead in them or decreasing the gold content or doing different things like that
Yes, that is correct. And the other thing is you'll notice like on coins of today, like even if we look at our little friend, the dime, you know, they've got little edges. I don't know if you can see that. Hopefully, I don't know, but it's tough because of the glare. There's little edges. See, there's little edges. Yep. And the reason they put little edges on the coins, this goes back historically, because that way you could tell if it had been shaved. Right. Now, nowadays, this isn't made out of real silver. This is junk.
Yeah.
But you know, what do you want to shave junk for? But you know, when it was really gold or silver or copper, they put these edges on historically so that you could tell whether or not it had been shaved by the mint or whoever. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
Now this is something I want to talk about. This is the glorious history of free money. And I'm glad that you alluded to this, Tim, because this is so important. These are all banknotes that go back to the First World War. There's a couple of them who happened afterwards, but for the most part. So Canada had a free banking system from 1817 to 1914. And the beauty behind that, we had the longest lasting free banking system in the world. God bless that. That's something you can be proud of as Canadians. Trudeau, you know, we'll all have our moments where we, you know, have sadness about how that happened. But the free banking system was a beautiful thing. And so, you know, you had the Bank of Montreal, Bank of Nova Scotia, Canadian Imperial Bank, Toronto Dominion. Our banks, our notes were not only good in Canada, but they were good in the Caribbean. They were good in London, okay, because you had to have a certain amount of gold or silver backing them up. And as long as you had that gold or silver, we had about 20 banks that were issuing currency of their own, right? And there was no central bank. As long as you, you know, held up to the standard of how much reserve you held, you could issue currency. You know?
Right. And I imagine, Rob, that if there was a bank that got a little bit too, let's say, liberal with its spending or with its lending, and it started handing out too many banknotes that it couldn't back up, eventually they'd be punished by the market because people wouldn't want to use those notes anymore. They wouldn't be able to exchange them and that money would become worthless and they'd go tits up. And, you know, the best money was winning at that point.
That's correct. It was a beautiful free market. It depended upon the bank's health and how much it held in reserve and how secure it was. Beautiful time. Beautiful time. If only we could go back to a system like that. And I'll show you as well, like when you see how many of these notes there are from different types of banks, some banks that don't exist today, okay? When I get into my later slides, one thing to remember is that Canada at that point, you know, we had a lot more banks than we do today. Today, we have less banks, chartered federal banks, than what Russia did in 1917 when Lenin went ahead and nationalized the banks. In other words, it's easier to nationalize the banks today by Trudeau than it was by Lenin in 1917. Think about the consequences of that.
Jeez, okay.
Yeah. So this starts with this Karl Marx. And I went down this rabbit hole because I had heard people who were running for the leadership of the province of Alberta who said that they thought that central bank digital currency was inevitable. And I thought to myself, oh, that doesn't sound right. I better look into this. I better go down the rabbit hole. And in doing so, Karl Marx in 1845 wrote this book called The Holy Family, along with Frederick Engels, and basically said he wanted to abolish money. That was the point. And you can read the quote there, but Marx was somebody who wanted to abolish money. Well, that, you know, so far that's just a theory. But then, as history proves out, we go forward to the Russian Revolution. So then what happens in the Russian Revolution is Russia, like all many countries during World War I, because war is such a massive expenditure, and they go ahead and devalue their currency and you know, remove it being pegged from gold or silver so they can just print money, print fiat currency type of thing to pay for the war. So 1914, June, Russia ends redeeming of the currency. Then in 1917, after the revolution in October, in November 20th, they have 12 banks holding 80% of the capital, and they nationalize all that. The reserves and the income are redirected to the government. So in Canada's example, that would be eliminating the banks, getting rid of their mandates, okay, which ironically has a date for June 30th of next year, 15 months from now. The Bank Act's been around in Canada for 105 years. It's never had an expiry date until Mr. Justin Trudeau, and now it has one of, like I said, June 30th next year, 2025.
Okay, I was wondering about that, Rob, because I've seen that before, and I thought, okay, well, if I'm looking at this in an optimistic way, maybe these things just have, maybe legislation just has expiry dates every 5 or 10 years or something, but you're saying no, there was no expiry date on this. And that was imposed. Okay. So we know that something's afoot. If you come in there and put an expiry date on legislation that's existed for a long time, you're planted some.
Yeah. So like I said, the Bank Act's been around for 105 years. It had a major rewrite. I think it was 2002, 2003. So 20 years ago. But then when he won the election in 2015, he went ahead and used probably an omnibus piece of legislation, which means they're making, you know, what they call housekeeping grammatical changes to a bunch of different laws. Most politicians don't pay attention to it. It's usually introduced in June before they break to go back to their ridings for Canada Day in July. And so people don't usually pay attention. And so first he set the date at 2019, and then he reset the date at 2025. Interesting. I've got
Wait a sec. This is blowing my mind. So he was this like the first year he was in power he did this?
The good question. I'm not sure if it was the first year, but I'm gonna take it back.
I mean, Justin Trudeau is just like a glorified frat boy, right? I mean, he's a good actor. I don't think he's that sharp or has like, I just don't buy that he's a puppet master pulling the strings. I feel like he's more of a tool.
Yeah.
So who are the people? Are we gonna get into who the people are or speculate who's?
Well, obviously the World Economic Forum is a dark entity that's promoting a lot of this evil. And I have to assume that they've got some strings they're pulling on them type of thing.
Because, I mean, they would have had to have this playbook ready to go. Okay, Justin Trudeau's in place. Because you're going through all this legislation, all that stuff, the homework would have been done. Here's what we need to change. Here's what we need to do. And put Pony Boy out in front and talk about social justice stuff and make everyone feel good. And we're going to just do some housekeeping, guys, just a little housekeeping on legislation. But they already knew what they were going to change. They already knew all the housekeeping they needed to do. Who's doing all that work?
One of the scary things, like I have a library, and one of the books I have in my library that I picked up was printed in 2002 And it talked about, you know, the upcoming crisis, the global, you know, climate, you know, blah, 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 in 2030. And from what I can tell is they originally set their sights on 2030 for all this massive catastrophe, this reckoning that they're setting up. But then they rolled it back to 2025. And I have to assume the reason is because they thought if we don't do it sooner, it might not happen. So
we're seeing the rise of right-wing populism. We see Javi Milei in Argentina and Bolsonaro and all these, and Trump and all these different, you know, it seems like people are getting sick of the left a lot sooner than I had anticipated. So, okay. Sorry to interrupt. That blew my mind.
Yeah. No, for sure. And so they go ahead and withdrawals of deposits are restricted. We've seen that in countries. Argentina's been through that, et cetera. Look at the stuff that we had with the truckers and the shutdown of those accounts. Okay, there was a precursor. Okay, so they created this Gauz Bank, which does not lend money. This is their central bank in the Soviet Union, but merely records records of transactions. Okay, and then in 1918, just to give you a sense of how this was working, they had 405 enterprises employing 205,000 people close due to a lack of credit, right? So you imagine what that would look like if you got rid of that type of credit in Canada, how many businesses would close? Think of how many closed during COVID. This would be even worse. And what they did is they went ahead and they raised taxes. And this is a way to compare, you know, the 1917 issue or 1918-19 to later on. £1 sterling was equal to 45 rubles. Right, the inflation rate in that year of 1918 was 598%, and then in 1919 the inflation rate goes to 1,376%, and then by August of 1920 they had 37,000 firms that were nationalized, 5,000 of them employed only one person. Imagine how ridiculous that is. The economy declines by 85%. They imposed wage and price controls. Where have you heard that stuff before, Mr. Trudeau's senior? With a government monopoly on grain handling, Canada Wheat Board, we've heard this before, right?
Yeah.
And then 1921, Lenin introduces the NEP. Once again, you've heard the NEP before.
Yeah,
that was number one.
National Energy Policy,
National Energy Policy. The Russians, the Soviets called it the New Economic Policy, but you've heard all this stuff before. Trudeaus are well-versed in this. And then you have Herbert Hoover's American Relief Administration provides, because you know, the Russians, the Soviets are starving to death. 237 ships, 21,000 kitchens, 768 million tons of flour, grain, rice, beans, pork, milk, and sugar. They had 125,000 Russians employed to unload, haul, weigh, cook, and serve the food. Now, important to remember here, now at this point, it gets so desperate when they're doing this to the economy. The 1923, £1 sterling is the equivalent of 5,040,000,000 rubles.
Wow.
Right? That's how bad the Russian currency destabilizes.
Right.
So this is exactly what Lenin's plan was. The way to crush the bourgeoisie is to grind them between the millstones of taxation and inflation.
Sounds real familiar.
Doesn't it though, eh? Doesn't it though?
Yeah.
So, and he also went on to say, hundreds of thousands of ruble notes are being issued daily by our treasury. This is done not in order to fill the coffers of the state with practically worthless paper, but with the deliberate intention of destroying the value of money as a means of payment. There is no justification for the existence of money in the Bolshevik state where the necessities of life shall be paid for by work alone. Experience has taught us it is impossible to root out the evils of capitalism merely by confiscation and expropriation. For however ruthlessly such measures may be applied, astute speculators and obstinate survivors of capitalist classes will always manage to evade them and continue to corrupt the life of the community. The simplest way to exterminate the very spirit of capitalism is therefore to flood the country with notes of high face value without financial guarantees of any sort. Mm-hmm. Already, even a 100 ruble note is almost valueless in Russia. Soon, even the simplest peasant will realize it is only a scrap of paper, not worth more than the rags from which it is manufactured. Men will cease to covet and hoard it. It so soon as they discover it will not buy anything, and the great illusion of the value and power of money on which the capitalist state is based will have been definitely destroyed. This is the real reason why our presses are printing ruble bills day and night without rest. Lenin, 1919.
Holy crap. Okay. So, I mean, they were saying the quiet part out loud then. I mean, he had no compunction about saying that, you know, it's very easy to look at people promoting central banking and say promoting like keeping interest rates suppressed at almost 0% as just kind of well-meaning idiots, you know? And maybe a lot of them are, you know, because they will use flowery kind of empathetic language to say, well, look, we need, you know, that this is needed to, people need houses, right? They can't afford houses. If we raise the interest rates, people need, you know, we need to stimulate consumption here. People need, you know, and so we need to print all this money, but surely there are people in that system that aren't that stupid, that know exactly what Lenin knew, which is we can destroy capitalism by making money useless. Is that your sense?
Yeah, well, I mean, the people that disturb me, like when I go and I talk about this, because I have a petition to reject central bank digital currency, when I meet a starving student ski bum who's like, I don't care, you know, well, they don't have much to, you know, for pennies to scrape together. I get the fact that they're just kind of out of it, right? But when I'm talking to a guy who's in a $5 million house, who obviously knows finances, is a smart guy, he's erudite, he's well-read, and I'm explaining to him what I'm explaining to you now, and at the end of it, they go, doesn't affect me, I don't care. That scares me, right? Because when bankers aren't paying attention to, say, for example, the changes in the Bank Act or what's going on, like, you know, in Alberta, we have Brett Olin with the Bow Valley Credit Union. That guy gets it. He and I are on the same wave of how to fix this. But there's other guys where I'm just like, it scares me because they're not paying attention to this stuff.
Yeah, man. Okay.
Yeah. So here you got examples of where, you know, Trudeau's, you know, raising the debt ceiling, spending $1 trillion, right? Unlimited. He wanted unlimited spending authority. And I'm going to give credit to Scott Reed, one of my colleagues, former colleagues in the House of Commons. Scott almost single-handedly stopped in early COVID from Trudeau getting this blank check with regard to spending during COVID, because he would have racked up even more debt at the time had he been allowed to. And Scott, bless his heart, deprived unanimous consent. So he deserves a hero cookie for having stopped Trudeau on this. Yeah.
Yeah, and audience, for those who don't know, Scott Reed is kind of known as one of the most libertarian members of parliament out there. So, yeah, good on him.
So the Soviets got so desperate. In 1929, the official estimates said that 5 million people starved to death. Unofficial estimates are that 10 million starved to death out of a population of 130 million. So one out of 13 people across the Soviet Union. And here's a picture of this boy in Zaporizhia, which we've heard of today because it's the largest nuclear power plant in Europe that, you know, the Russians have blown the dams on. And so it's short of water and it's potentially going to overheat. This boy was found guilty of killing his 3-year-old brother and eating him. Okay. Like, look how starved that kid is.
It's amazing. Right?
Cannibalism. So the Soviets were actually worried that the Soviet experiment would disappear from the face of the earth, because within 4 years of this no money, high tax, high inflation policy, this is what resulted.
Right.
That's how bad it got. So the caloric intake dropped from 3,820 calories per day down to 2,680, fell by 30%. So for the people who didn't starve to death, this is the equivalent. It went from 3 poutines, McDonald's poutines, down to 2 a day. And I'm not talking a glass of juice or a glass of milk or anything else, or even ketchup in addition to that. Like, that's it. Right. That's what they were surviving on.
Okay. This is in Russia.
Yeah, that's right.
Interesting.
So what they did is they got so desperate that I actually have a copy of one of these. It's a silver Kopeck, but you can see it on your screen there. And they got so desperate that even though they hated money and were trying to destroy it as best they could, they were starving their population to death. They had the British mint these silver coins in 1921, these silver Kopecks, because it got so bad, nobody trusted the Russians to print or sort of mint their own coins. They thought they would do it out of aluminum or tin or whatever. So they got the British to do it because everybody trusted the British with pound sterling. So they printed up or minted up these silver coins. And by 1923, they were minting these gold coins because it failed. This experiment failed horribly and nearly starved the Soviet Union to death.
Right. So this is the government getting real money minted?
That's right.
They realize that they actually do need a medium of exchange. Imagine that. Right. I just want to go back for a second, because this poutine you know, this drop in calories reminds me of kind of what's going on right now, where we're seeing, well, they call it foodflation, right? And of course, Jagmeet Singh and his ilk are blaming greedy CEOs as if CEOs just suddenly got greedy in the last 2 or 3 years and were never greedy before, as an explanation as to why this is happening. But yeah, I mean, we're seeing smaller portions of food for the same price at restaurants and fast food places and different things like that, right? So,
And so, you know, the question is, do you trust Justin Trudeau? Because what this stuff does, central bank digital currency does, is it allows the central bank, like in other words, if I use the Alberta Treasury branch card that I've got and I go and purchase poutine or, you know, whatever, okay, they know about my transactions, but they are not compelled, you know, to relate that information to the federal government, to the central bank, to the Bank of Canada. But when you have a central bank digital currency, therefore, the Bank of Canada can trace all your transactions. If you buy ivermectin, right? What is your environmental social governance score? You know, in China, they call that your social credit score. Okay. You know, China has this digital yuan, and they're one of the big drivers of this. And we'll talk about why.
Well, yeah. And that reminds me of this lady I know who, she flies from Calgary to Vancouver regularly for business trips. And, you know, she's an environmentally conscious lady. She likes to feel like she's contributing to being a good global citizen. Let's say she has a Visa card or a credit card that has that is like a climate card or whatever. It contributes a certain amount to, I don't know, carbon capture or something, whatever. But she wasn't able to purchase a plane ticket with it because she exceeded her maximum allotted plane. Like she was emitting too much carbon dioxide. And so now that was a voluntary thing. That was her volunteering for something stupid, but now that's going to be imposed on us by it sounds of it with this CBDC. Hey, you're using up too much carbon dioxide. You're taking too many trips. You've done too many vacations. You don't need 2 vacations a year. You only need one, and you don't need to go that far. You can drive. You don't need to fly. I mean, you can see how easily it would be to control these things.
For sure. And this, you know, in China here, you know, we go with this, you know, if you criticize the government, then your social credit score drops and you can't buy plane tickets, train tickets, bus tickets. You get fined. There's expiration dates that are put on your money if you don't invest in what the government wants you to do. The Chinese hate things like Bitcoin, etc., because there's no they don't believe in free trading. So here's the issue. Like, this is why central banks love this, particularly the Chinese and the dictatorships. Okay, because when China actually opens up their currency to the free market, it floods out. The Chinese themselves don't trust their own government. I mean, that's the reason why Vancouver housing prices are so inflated, because they'd rather own someplace they don't even live in that's growing weeds or whatever in Vancouver than have the money in their bank, right? They don't trust their own government. So they flood the currency out. But when you have a central bank, what happens is the central bank of China negotiates with the Canadian central bank or the American central bank or all the various central banks and says, this is what the exchange rate is. So once you set that between the central banks and you get rid of a lot of the private banks, well, there's no place for the money to flow, you see. So the autocracies, the tyrannies, they love this stuff because it prevents the free exchange of money. It prevents private exchange and the idea that the private market can have its own mechanisms to determine what the value of a currency is. If you don't have cash, it's just central banks sitting down negotiating with each other what they think each other's worth.
Right. Yeah. And I think a key point here, Rob, too, that you kind of turned me on to that I hadn't thought of before is I'm like, okay, well, you know, like all my transactions, I very rarely will do a cash transaction anymore. It's just too inconvenient to go to the bank. And so I'm like, well, they have all my information already. So is CBDC going to really, it's going to take us from 95% to 100%. But what you're saying is that right now the central bank and the government doesn't have immediate access to my transactions. The central bank digital currency means that they'll be able to control that. And they'll be able to, and right now we have in Canada, we have hate speech legislation or anti-bullying or something like that, that basically criminalizes thought and emotion and actually criminalizes pre-thought and emotion. If someone's worried about you, that you might engage in hate speech, they have the ability to punish you, but they have to go through due process. And there's kind of some steps there. With the central bank digital currency, they wouldn't even have to do that. I mean, the government could just on a whim, just by fiat, say, listen, if someone is suspected of engaging in anti-establishment speech, which they'll label extreme right-wing speech or extreme hate speech or bigotry, then the taps are shut off. They are no longer able to operate in this market, in commercial society or in society at all, until they get on board with the program.
Well, this is where that 15-minute city stuff ties in, right? If you're driving too much, if you're using too much fuel, you're right, buying too much ammo, you know, you're buying guns, you know, you're doing things the government doesn't like, right? Then they can go ahead and shut off your bank accounts. And look what they did to the people who supported the truckers.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, you know, some people will say, look, 15-minute cities, this was something developed by city planners just to make more livable communities or whatever. And that may be the case. That may be where it started. I don't know. But of course, social engineers and central planners are going to use that concept and leverage it to not make voluntary communities that are all walkable, but impose communities that you must walk in, right? So, yeah.
I remember when I first got elected as a member of parliament back in the 90s, and Reg Alcock was a colleague of mine for the Liberals. He's since passed away. But, you know, I remember we had presentations in, I think it was the Transport Committee, where I was there with Lee Morrison and what have you. And they were talking about these smart cities and these, you know, traffic lights that would monitor how many cars there were behind each one. They didn't mention that it would track each individual car. They were talking about how it would track the number of cars behind a given light and determine when the light's green, red, you know, yellow, whatever would go. But you realize now that they have the ability to track cars. Why are they doing that? Why is London imposing fines on people if they use their car at the wrong day of the week, you know, et cetera, right? They can't renew their licenses if they don't pay the fines, et cetera.
Right, right.
This has implications, folks.
Right, right. And, you know, but people will say, well, okay, they're just managing traffic and just trying to figure out how to optimize a city or whatever. But, okay, would you then be opposed to those same cameras monitoring faces and using facial recognition technology and AI to track people movement and see where they're going? Would you then say it's just optimizing movement and optimizing spaces for people? Do you see any nefarious ways this can be used against the population and against the individual to control them? Of course, they'll be controlled.
I remember immediately after 9/11, where we were in a hotel in downtown Ottawa, and there was a, you know, hors d'oeuvres and kind of soiree thing after the boats, and literally walked into this room, and it was showing how at that time, and this is like over a decade ago, this is a long time ago, might have been 2 decades ago, where it was literally tracking everybody in the room based on facial recognition software. You know? Wow. So now we're going to talk about what's happening, not just in China, but other countries that are actually, they're testing this stuff out. So in April of 1980, Zimbabwe had a dollar that was higher than the United States. But since that time, they've had a drastic drop in food production, an inability to obtain loans. Manufacturing fell by 29% in 2005, 26% in 2006, 28% in 2007. They had excessive money creation. The government violence was used to stifle political opposition. Mining declined. Banks once again restricted the ability to withdraw currency, truckers type stuff, right? And in 2008, a US dollar was now worth $2,621,984,228 in the Zimbabwean dollar, right, in their currency.
Right. Well, I've got a $10 trillion Zimbabwe bill. Actually, it's right here. No, I don't have it handy, but I paid. I think $10 for it.
Yeah. So. it just shows you what happens with this stuff, right? And so in December 2015, the finance minister said the yuan, the digital yuan out of China, would be their new main reserve currency. Well, that's pretty funky when you think about it, that Zimbabwe in Africa was going to implement the digital yuan from China. And so what happened? Out of the 9 legal currencies that were available to them type of thing, 90% used the US dollar, 5% used the South African rand. But you know, people, thank goodness, reject this stuff, but only if they have the ability to, right? As best they can. But when various governments get rid of these private banks and move over to this central bank type stuff, and the private bankers have to ask themselves a question, right? Some of these people can be the useful idiots in this thing, where if the government has a central bank digital currency and it's tracking all the transactions, and the Canada Revenue Agency can say, hey, we notice a discrepancy between, you know, what you declare and what you're spending, and we're going to assess you an extra $10,000, you know, assessment, et cetera, blah, blah, blah. So at some point, you know, the private banks become less relevant. They need less employees. You know, why do they need tellers anymore, right? Why do they need, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Banking machines, right? Like they have to ask themselves these questions. Where is this going?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's interesting too. It reminds me a little bit. I had an Argentinian on my podcast here a little while ago to talk about Javi Milei, and he was saying similar things. You know, they've had 150% inflation year over year there for decades. And most Argentinians keep US dollars under their mattress because that's the only money that's worth anything there. They, you know, that's how they save money. And so it'll be interesting to see how Javi Milei solves this problem. It sounds like he's basically shutting down the central bank in Argentina and dollarizing their economy to the US with the hopes of eventually going to like a free banking system. But I'm sure he'll be up against a few dark forces. The one good thing is that he's kind of cozying up to the US, which might be a good strategy, because other leaders, you know, you think of Saddam Hussein and the fellow there in Libya, Muammar Gaddafi, a lot of these guys didn't fare so well when they decided to go their own way and kind of disembark from central bank funny money, let's say. But
yeah, so you know what they do in these countries where they're testing this stuff out, and I'll talk about how it's coming to Canada if we don't change the system the way it's going. They eliminate the large bills, right? In Canada, we've already got rid of the $1,000 notes, the $500 notes, $10,000 notes. We used to have some of those. Those are gone. They're out of circulation. They restrict account access. There becomes a currency shortage. There's riots usually that go with that. And then what they do is a currency swap with China. So Nigeria is in this position. I was just talking about Zimbabwe, for example. And, you know, here in Canada, right, we've got this lady on the back of our notes. She's passed away. You see, the queen is no longer with us.
Oh, yeah.
Isn't, and she's also, you know, for example, you know, on our quarters. And she's on, obviously, all of our coins, right? She's on our dimes, right? So that's a perfect excuse to take her out of circulation, right?
Right.
You say, well, you know, it's Charles now. The monarch's passed away. It's no longer Queen Elizabeth II. So it's an excuse for Trudeau to go ahead and say, we have to pull that money out of circulation.
Right.
You see? And also the date that he set for this to happen, with regard to the banks losing their mandate, our private banks or our federally chartered banks losing their mandate in June 30th of next year, 15 months from now, is that Parliament usually recesses in the middle of June. And then, you know, the Senate recesses shortly thereafter for whatever key pieces of government legislation they wanted to get through. So within a week of that, say by, you know, June 20-something, it's all shut down. So that they can all be back in the riots for Canada Day. That means he has all of July, all of August, probably all of September, 3 months before he has any parliamentary oversight, before the House of Commons or the Senate returns, to do whatever he wants with regard to the banking system.
Oh my God. Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think he knows he's being used as a pawn, or?
Well, I think there's some measure of him thinking, oh, I'm one of the cool kids club because I hang out with Klaus Schwab and some of these other characters in Davos. But little do these people realize that, you know, you're just kind of a useful idiot. Like, he's not the sharpest knife in the drawer. They know that. Yeah. Even the Liberal caucus and the cabinet know that. And so this guy's going to have done what he needs to do. He'll have followed his orders. But at the end of the day, you know, he's not the one with the million person army like the Chinese have, et cetera, blah, blah, blah. I mean, they're the ones driving a lot of this because they don't want a free floating currency that actually trades on Forex exchanges because people don't trust them. But once they have everybody's dealing with central banks and you don't have to deal with private, you know, currency exchanges, well, China can be even harsher than it is now. And Trudeau, for all of his admiration of the basic dictatorship of the Chinese system, can be even harsher than he is. And we all know how bad he is.
Yeah, my God.
Or somebody else they supplant him with.
Yeah.
So another country that's, you know, trying to go to a central or dealing with it in a different way is El Salvador, right? So they went toward Bitcoin, okay? And I, like, for example, if somebody wants to invest in Bitcoin, that's their business, you know, same as if they want to invest in gold, silver, copper, oil, whatever, that's their business. I just don't like the idea of the government mandating it, right? Mm-hmm. I don't like them saying you have to do it this way. Yeah. Just like with Franklin Delano Roosevelt, you know, I didn't like the idea that the government would mandate people to say you can't have gold, right? I don't agree with that.
Right.
But that's where all of this, you know, tyranny type stuff, you know, goes to, is they try to force you into their way of exchange, et cetera. And that's why I love the free banking system that Canada had back from 1817 to 1914. It was the longest lasting free banking system in the world, and we should be proud of it and at some stage return to that.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
And then you talk about, you know, who's driving some of this stuff. It's just sad, but I mean, this stuff I think has been in the plans for decades. When you look at some of this environmental crisis stuff, some of the books that I have in my library, and the Schwab character and their plans, you know, the control freaks love central bank digital currency because they can track everything you do.
Yeah, they sure do. And yeah, I mean, Klaus Schwab knows what's best for all of us, right? I mean, he's our dear father figure, just wants the best for all of us, wants best for the world. And if we just submit, well, life will be so much better. It'll be a brave new world.
Will Dove did a great thing where he exposed the date, right, of this stuff that was going on back on January 4th earlier this year, where he exposed the changes that were there, the expiry dates with regard to the federal mandates in the banks. And God bless him for doing that, because that's key, folks. You don't put an expiry date in a 105-year-old piece of legislation that hasn't had expiry dates before unless you're up to something. So let's talk now about what I see as some of the solutions. So you can either A, have an election and get rid of Justin Trudeau, yay, okay, or B, but that's dependent on Jagmeet Singh. We have to find out, you know, how badly corrupted he is with regard to this. He should have got rid of him already. But anyhow, NDPers should be rising up in protest saying, hey, we could become the official opposition. Why are we still backing this guy? Anyhow, hopefully he collapses him over the budget because he could become leader of the official opposition, right? I mean, his salary goes up, his pension goes up. Come on, Jagmeet, what's up? Are you part of the Trudeau program, or are you your own independent guy? What's going on? Another thing that you can do is you can amend the Bank Act so that it doesn't have this mandated timeout, this expiry date next year in June 30th. Another thing is that provinces can go ahead, like Daniel Smith here in Alberta, and say, well, we want to see our Alberta regulated financial institutions peg 3%, let's say, of their assets to gold, silver, maybe copper, you know, maybe oil, et cetera. So it's something tangible. And you know, in Alberta, we've had a history, for example, like, you know, the Alberta Social Credit Government put out the prosperity certificates around the time of the Calgary Stampede. Calgary also puts out its own dollars and stuff, right? So we have a history of having done this before. But in this respect, she has the power, the province has the power. I know that Brett Oland with Bow Valley Credit Union has already mandated that his organization will pay 10% of their assets to gold. God bless him. Because he realizes the consequences of all this stuff. And I want to see the other ones like Service Credit Union, the Christian Credit Union, the Alberta Treasury Branch, et cetera, do the same and all come to an agreement about that, or have the government of Alberta say that that's the way it's going, because that will create a ripple effect in the marketplace where people with loans and bank accounts and credit cards will say, we're going to switch over to these guys because it's sound money.
Right.
And you know, the federal government doesn't have control over that. So I'd like to see Saskatchewan, which has a conservative leaning government, obviously Ontario, do that. And if that happened, it would create a bulwark against Trudeau trying to collapse the federal currency.
Hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting idea. So what's the name of your buddy who wants to do 10%, or what's his bank?
It's Brett Oland with Bow Valley Credit Union. It's based out of Cochrane. And I've talked to him on a few different occasions. I regularly trade emails back and forth with him. I was at his presentation that he did in Cochrane. It was where I did this presentation earlier to that. And he gets it. Like, right. He understands it. Like, I, first off, I'm going to tell you, I'm not a banker. I'm not an economist. I'm not an accountant. But I've researched this enough. I've read enough books on it and gone down enough rabbit holes on YouTube that I think I get it. Unfortunately, you know, a lot of other people haven't done that. And I get it. They're busy. They're taking kids to soccer. They're doing whatever. But, you know, folks, this will affect you. And those people who think that they're insulated and they're fine, whatever. No. If the government tracks every single transaction, and, you know, if many of these banks fail because they don't have real hard assets. And, you know, like, let's talk about some challenges just for a second to the U.S. dollar. OK, you've got, say, for example, the euro. OK, I think the euro will crash. It's just a matter of time. I believe that Margaret Thatcher was right in the 1980s when she said the only thing that made sense was the common market for Europe, where there was lower tariffs, lower barriers to trade, so that the purchasing power in the individual countries was more. So the Czechs filling their crystal without restriction or less taxes, you know, got more money for it, more purchasing power. Same with the British selling their cod, same with the Germans selling their steel. She said that made sense. But the idea that there were going to be no immigration controls, and the idea, for example, that they were going to have this centralized, you know, currency, the euro, well, each country has 20-some variables in its macroeconomic formula, times 20-some countries. To figure out the value of the euro at any given stage, you're dealing with 400 to 500, you know, variables.
Right.
You know, and you're carrying the debts of Portugal, Italy, Greece, Spain. They're all insolvent, right? They're economic basket cases. The British left. The bankers in London decided, we don't want part of this anymore. We're out of here, right? We don't want to fund this whole thing. And the bankers in Frankfurt are in the same scenario right now because the Germans are the ones holding the bag. And with them voting for the Alternative for Deutschland, they're wanting out of it. It's just a matter of time. So the Germans aren't going to be holding the bag. That thing's going to crash. I just wish I knew within what 90-day period so I could buy puts and make a fortune, right?
Right.
So there's that. You look at the other challenge to the U.S. dollar, this BRICS scenario, Brazil, Russia, India, you know, China, and South Africa. Well, if you look at that, there's only two countries in that whole scenario that have over 1,000 tons of gold, that what they claim. Okay. Mm. The Chinese claim to have 3,000 tons. The Russians claim to have 2,000 tons. I don't trust the Russians on how much gold they have. They're not going to allow in an acid test, you know, on that stuff. They're spending fortunes on the war. You don't think they've already, you know, sent that over to China to buy for more bullets or, you know, artillery or whatever, blah, blah, blah. China claims they have 3,000 tons of gold. Once again, a lot of it hasn't been bought on the open markets. They said they created it, you know, mined it inside China. I don't trust them. They lied about Wuhan. You know, they lied about 300 million people in their population. Like, you can't trust these guys. So if I'm the bankers in Zurich or other places, why would I trust the Chinese on this stuff, right? Yeah. So I think that is ultimately going to fail. Now, the U.S., despite the fact that Nixon unpegged from gold in 1971 because he didn't want de Gaulle to haul his gold back to France from the U.S., the U.S. still stopped selling their gold, so they still have about 8,000 tons. The Germans have about 2,000 tons, about 75%, you know, with the U.S. to be able to play the currency exchange markets and whatever. So they still have twice as much just between the two countries as those other
guys.
Hey,
Rob, how much gold does Canada have?
Zero. Zero. Like, it's like literally probably like 100 ounces. Canada is one of 12 countries in the world that has no gold bullion reserves. The only thing we have is the stuff that's in either Winnipeg or Ottawa at the mint to print mint coins. That's it.
Right.
So our currency relative to, like, this stuff, you know, this is toilet paper, folks. When this reverberation happens, this stuff is toilet paper. The only thing we got going for this is 60% of our trade with the U.S. market to the south. That's it.
Right. Well, you're not painting a very rosy picture for the future. So it sounds like BRICS is on its last leg. I'd argue that the central banking in the West here is probably on its last leg. The Euro's on its last leg. This doesn't sound like a recipe for peace, does it?
Well, I think the $64,000 question, as they used to say on the old game show, is whether or not the United States will be forced to repeg to gold. Right. I don't know. And if that's the case, gold goes from $2,000 an ounce to like $4,000, $6,000, $8,000, $9,000, who knows? Yeah. Because it's a mess, folks. So this is what I was talking about before with regard to the percentages, right? So we have these provincially incorporated financial institutions. Now their duty is to operate in a safe and sound manner. And in 1844 in England, Sir Robert Peel put forward the Bank Act. And in 1913, there was the Federal Reserve Act. In 1971, Nixon unpegged from the gold standard in August because he worried about de Gaulle taking back the gold for France. Originally, it was around 25% of your assets that you had to hold in gold. Eventually, by 71, it was down to like 3%. And that's where I advocate for provincially incorporated financial institutions. They go back to 3%. Because it creates sound money. And despite Trudeau trying to crash this all, and God knows he is, if we don't have an election, if we don't change the Bank Act, this collapse in Canada's context, can happen as of June 30th next year.
Right.
Right. And so I want people to understand this.
Yeah. When is the next election slated for? When does it need to happen?
October.
October, yeah. So he can sneak this in, get this under. If an election is called, are you confident that the Conservatives will avert catastrophe?
Well, you never know until somebody's actually in power. Yeah. But, I mean, I would take Pierre Poilievre over Justin Trudeau any day of the week.
Sure.
Yeah. Right? I've run under the Reform Party, under the Canadian Alliance, under the Conservative Party. I've had different prime ministers, etc. None of them are perfect. No leader is perfect. No party is perfect. But I would take Pierre Poilievre over Justin Trudeau any day.
Yeah. Well, amen to that. Oh, man. Okay. You've given us a lot to think about here, Rob. What advice would you have for just people that are listening to this and absolutely horrified at the prospect of CBDC and what's happening?
Well, use cash as much as you can, because it makes it harder for the government to track stuff and keeps cash alive. Also, if you can, set up a bank account and start doing stuff with these provincially regulated financial institutions, because they will have the ability to tread water and to survive potentially the federal government trying to crash the federal currency. It's a real fly in the ointment for Trudeau and for the World Economic Forum and some of these folks. So please do think about that. Because, the people who, and I have roommates who are bankers from Venezuela that work at, for example, the Bank of Nova Scotia, what have you, for those people who work in the federally chartered banks in Canada, wake up, this stuff is going to hurt. It's going to mean a bunch of firings and layings offs in the banks, because once you have a central bank digital currency, why do you need, the bank tellers or the machines to distribute this stuff, right?
Right.
There's a lot more government control of the economy, et cetera, blah, 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 blah. You can see history is telling us exactly where this is going. Like when I started researching this and I realized how this all tied into Karl Marx and what the Soviets were doing in 1917 and everything else.
Yeah.
They're just doing it with fancier tools now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like that idea of banking, with one of these credit unions like Bow Valley Credit Union, that where the guy actually has an understanding of the macroeconomic forces at play here and what's coming down the pipe, because those are the guys that are going to be best able to protect your wealth, I think. If we just hand it to an establishment guy who's going along with everything and has no skeptical eye at all to all the money printing, I mean, your money's as good as gone as far as I could tell. So
And educate people. Like I almost every day am going out and door knocking, telling people about, my petition to reject central bank digital currency. I'm explaining this stuff, in a thumbnail sketch version of what we've done here at the doors. And I'm trying to educate people. And when you tell them it's based on the Chinese digital yuan, they kind of go, and you say, yeah, did you know the Bank Act's going to expire on June 30th next year? And they kind of get wide eyed, and they start muttering under their breath sometimes, like, son of a bitch, that Trudeau, you know. But, you know, you have to educate people, because most people, they don't have the time, I get it,
yeah,
to do the research that I've done to read about, you know, Marx and the Holy Family and whatever. They're not into that stuff. But it's important, because that's telling us where this is going.
Yeah, no doubt. So you have a petition that you're created. Is there an online link to that?
I don't, but I'll try to set that up, Jiffy, because it's important, and people need to understand, you know, we need to oppose this stuff, and it's part of the education process. And every time we get 25 signatures, another member of parliament, a former colleague of mine in the House of Commons, can stand up and speak to these things, and getting them to do that educates them too.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, as soon as you have a link, or let me know, and guys, I'll put it in the show notes below and tweet it out and do different things like that. Rob, I appreciate you coming on. I appreciate you fighting for us and making us aware of this threat that's going down. Any last words or anything you want to promote?
Jagmeet Singh, have an election, become a leader of the official opposition, increase your salary, protect your pension, get rid of Trudeau. You can do it.
Yes. Amen. All right, guys. Thanks for having us. Make sure you hit subscribe and get notified when new episodes drop. Follow us on Rumble and on Spotify. And Robin, once again, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me on. Thank you.